Are you ready for the Low Blows Network?
Hi guys, Rick here. Before we get to this episode of Paddy's New Yacht, I'd like to talk briefly about gambling because it'll be discussed a lot on this show. Gambling is supposed to be fun and accoutrement to your sporting weekend. However, it can also be debilitating and ruin lives. If you find that your gambling gets in the way of work, school or other activities, causes mental or physical health issues, causes any issues in your life, gives you financial stress of any kind or damages your reputation, then gambling may be a danger to you. If you spot any of these signs in yourself, stop gambling immediately, consult problemgambling.ie for all resources that can assist you and help yourself before it's too late. And now, on to Paddy's New Yacht.
Former pro wrestler Rick Nash and former Paddy Power insider David Kent are not good gamblers. But they're sports fanatics who are determined to crack the code and make it rich on sports gambling or die trying.
This time next year, we'll be millionaires.
Follow them on their journey to eventual bankruptcy every Friday on the Low Blows Network with sports tips that made so much sense at the time in Paddy's New Yacht.
I'm not going to lie, when we made the decision to bring back Paddy's New Yacht for a limited run for the Euros, part of it was like, yeah, look, I love doing this show and I've missed it while we weren't able to do it weekly and stuff like that because life got in the way, but also as well, part of it was just based around the idea that the Euros weren't going to be that interesting after the long season that we had. And I love international tournaments so much that I didn't want the kind of lack of quality in football or stories or this or that to take away from what like I enjoyed about European championships. But holy crap. It's like, and it's been great to have the podcast here for that as well, to kind of react in real time. It's been amazing. And we're going to discuss it as we get to the final episode of our limited run here in Paddy's New Yacht. We're going to be discussing it all as we go on and reflecting on the tournament as well as giving our final preview. But it's been amazing. And as we get started here, we're going to be discussing, giving out awards as we go on. But I just want to get kicked off here, David Kent of the Irish Mirror, with what was your favorite story? So just news story or anything. It can be a storyline, whatever you want. What was your favorite story from Euro 2020?
I mean, the organizers of this tournament and the officials in this tournament, it must be huge fans of the Low Blows Network, because there's been a long-running storyline from the first match of heel face with VAR. Okay. So look, the build beforehand, we watched it all year in the Premier League. It was absolutely terrible, and yet it was fine in every other league. Don't know what that's got to do with it. But like, the first bell rings, and it's a face straight off the bat. Most decisions are correct. There are a couple of dodgy ones hinting at a heel turn to come, again, involving English officials. Then, just as it turns into the John Cena of the tournament, nothing can, like, this can never turn heel. It's all good. We get the heel turn in Wembley under the pressure of the home crowd in the semi-final of the weekend. It was Austin McMahon levels of heat over here and seemingly everywhere else by not overturning the decision for the Raheem Sterling penalty and putting England through to the final. Great, great, but great long-term booking, great game of heel face.
Amazing stuff. We will discuss the penalty shortly and the semi-finals. I want to talk, though, not about one of the players or participants in Euro 2020, I want to talk about one of the players' mothers. And I don't know how many of you would have heard this story, but it's an amazing one, because in the aftermath of France's elimination from the tournament as favourites, losing, of course, on penalties, the mother of Adrien Rabiot went to the parents of both Kylian Mbappe and Paul Pogba and scolded them for not doing enough for their children that allowed them to make those mistakes after France's loss on penalties to Switzerland. Like, consider this as well. Like, Mbappe is going to be hurting, and now his parents are getting attacked by one of the parents of the squad. And also as well, Paul Pogba, you may remember in particular, scored a spectacular goal during that match. What else did you want, Veronique? But absolutely amazing stuff. Murder in the French camp. Like, it's fantastic. The world champions just coming apart
apart at the seams, but on the pitch and behind the scenes as well. Fantastic stuff. But we will get to kind of our awards as we go on. But first off, let's just touch on the semis. We'll start with kind of Italy and Spain. And the question kind of coming in was, I think, you know, we've been writing Spain off, and we'll discuss them shortly. We've been writing Spain off a lot throughout the tournament, and they really kind of put together a solid performance here, where some would argue they deserve to be in the final based on that performance alone, if not the full tournament. But obviously, Italy are coming in without probably their best player for the entire tournament, with Spinazzola being out. Do you think Italy are the same side without him? And do you think that kind of exposed them? Or is this more like the Austria win for Italy, where they kind of, you know, they had a tough game and came through it? And with a semi-final, it doesn't matter how you get there, just get on the winning side, and they've done that. How did you kind of read that match?
It was always going to be a big adaptation from, as you say, Luca Spinazzola, who had been probably their player in the tournament, probably the player the entire tournament. So they had to bring in Emerson as well. So it was more a sense that when the midfield were under pressure for Italy, they used to just look at Spinazzola, look at Di Lorenzo to kind of release the pressure. Whereas Emerson coming in, he hadn't had that much time in a few appearances off the bench, or I think he had one or 20 minutes in the group, but he hadn't had too much in that situation. It's come into that in the semi-final against a team who presses as high and as well as Spain and who were as well drilled. It was a bit of, I don't know if it was maybe a bit of shell shock for him, but I wouldn't read massively into it, because, as you say, they are in the final now. So they got the job done regardless. And this team dynamic, and I'll get to it later on as well, that it really have, it's more like it's all for one and one for all. There's no kind of one player is bigger than the team. Like, so, for example, if France lost Mbappe or England lost Kane, they might be in a bit of bother. Whereas Italy, like, don't seem to have that. There are things that do concern me from that game, but I think Mancini will possibly have learned enough from it in the final. So again, it'll all come down to team selection on both sides. Well, again, we're going to talk about this in a while, but I'm not reading too much into the pressure that
Sunday's a new day. That's fair. And we've seen Italy, we've doubted Italy already. Like we said, the Austria game, and then they came back better and kind of put Belgium out with style. So that's fair. They've kind of earned our respect. Let's talk about the England-Denmark game. Let's touch on it briefly. And you mentioned it there. Like, was it a penalty? Because I don't know, I'm kind of split on this.
I initially said, like, in real time when watching, I said penalty. Then, naturally, because we didn't get a proper replay, we didn't get a VAR angles at all. And then it was only when Kevin Doyle, a former professional footballer himself, pointed out that if a player's running at that speed, it doesn't take a lot to knock him in general. Mm. And we criticise players for not going down in these situations and other things. And he does get clipped, like, if you watch the slow-mo, he does get a clip on the knee. And then, like, all right, it might not be, if it was shoulder to shoulder, I'd say, yeah, maybe not. But if you're running that speed and you're dipping and diving in and out and you get a clip, that can throw you off. And he does get barged for the second one anyway. I don't understand the massive anger about it either. That penalty would be given in Old Trafford every other week with a crowd in it. It would be given in the Allianz Arena. It would be given anywhere in the world where there's a crowd. At home support and in that kind of situation. So should the ref maybe have stood up a bit and maybe gone over and looked at the monitor, possibly, but he wasn't instructed to. I do think the crowd played a part, but I do think on the basis it was a penalty, it was a foul, and if it was up to pitch as well, if it was on the halfway line, you probably would have been asking for it as well. So
this is what I call a Martial penalty. Because it's like, and if you've watched United over the past 2 years, not so much like towards the later end of last season, but like particularly when Martial was playing week in, week out for us, and we were getting penalties left, right and centre, and that was almost part of our game plan. Martial gets the penno and Bruno comes up and scores it. It's like one of these where we give the ball to a pacey player, have him run straight into the box with no particular game plan in mind, but just knowing that he's like both pacey enough and he's skillful enough to keep the ball away from them. And also he's going to get tripped at some point because he's too fast that they're going to react. And I see why it angers people. It always winds people up. And people say that, like, people used to give out about Martial and Man United saying that, you know, you always get penalties. And yeah, we did. We played for it. Like, and we looked for it. But it's also valid because we were getting tripped. Like, you know what I mean? There was contact there. Sterling, there was... Okay, arguably the first, like, I think it was a bit of a dive, But like I don't think there was contact off the first player off Male. I think it was the second contact that there was a body check. And I think that came in where that makes it a penalty because, and also as well, it's just Sterling like had their number. And I'm going to discuss this quite a lot today. I have a lot of good to say about Raheem Sterling on this show. But like, he just had their number. He was just one step ahead of them and they just couldn't contain him. And he was literally, they're putting their foot in as he's on the turn. And that's one of those where it's not nice. And if you're supporting the other team, you're going to feel hard done by because you can see that he's going for it. And you can see that it's probably not going to be a goal if you just let him go. But the fuck up is on the part of the defenders there. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. He got them, do you know? And it's a penalty. And I know we mightn't like it because it's England and now they're in the final and we'll have to deal with this if they win for decades to come. But I think it was a penalty. Anyway, look, we will discuss kind of the teams that have departed and obviously the teams that are still with us as we go. We're going to preview the final later on. The way we're going to do it is we're going to take a team each and we're going to kind of argue the case for them and then kind of give our final predictions and our bets as well. But before we get started, I do want to kind of reflect on the tournament as a whole and I've kind of done some like kind of awards that we can give out as well for particular, like, you know, things as we kind of look back at it because we won't have another show after this to kind of look back on everything. So first off, and again, like, let's hope that the winner of all these awards after Sunday is overturned and the final wins everything, you know. But the match of the tournament, what is it for you?
I had this one in my head since it happened, and it's not the Netherlands and Ukraine. That's probably a close second, but it has to be France and Switzerland for me, purely because of the attitude going into it. It's because it was like everyone thought beforehand, oh, geez, right, France, Switzerland, France 3 or 4-0, whatever. And then an hour beforehand, we had Spain and Croatia. So like, okay, look, Grant, that's the excitement out of the way for the day. This second game has no chance of living up to it. And then Switzerland went 1-0 up and you're like, oh, wow, we have like, we saw France against Hungary and we saw France maybe struggle a bit during the group stage. But, you know, it's only Switzerland. They did it against Portugal. They did it against Germany. And then, of course, 2 and 5 minutes from Benzema, you're like, right, yep, there it is. They're sorted now. Another one, just like as you mentioned, that absolute worldie from Pogba into the like arrowing into the top right corner. You're like, right, Grant, 3-1 ahead, 9 minutes to go. This is sorted. And look, we all know what happened. The two late goals, but then you're like, oh, Grant, okay, it's fine. Like, listen, they've equalised. France will get them an extra time. They have a much stronger squad depth. They can't break them down. And then, like, of all players to then miss the crucial penalty, Mbappe, the golden boy, and you're just like, unbelievable. Hour and a half. Unbelievable day of football, as we talked about before. An unbelievable hour and a half of football as well.
I went for France, Switzerland too, and I think it's going to be the one we remember. And I've spoken about this before, so I'm not going to go into it. I'm just going to recap it there. But like I said before, it broke my reality. You know what I mean? It literally made me question reality as I went on. I went full. Maybe it's just because I'm watching Loki kind of in conjunction with a lot of this tournament, and that's kind of messing with my concept of reality as well. But this is like, it can't happen. They're not going to come back from 3-1 down in the last 10 minutes again. That's not a thing that happens. And of course it did. And then Mbappe scored. And it's just like, how we literally saw France be the best team in the world. We saw them grow into it and become it in a 10-15 minute period. It's like, okay, the problem is solved. We're back. Don't worry, guys. We're taking over and we're going to win the entire tournament. That's the way we felt about it. And then in just 10 manic minutes, it all turned around. Then you had extra time. Then you had penalties. And of course, like you said, to come down to Mbappe, just sensational, sensational stuff. Goal of the tournament for you?
Was torn between three. Anders Christensen, as I talked about before, for Denmark against Russia. The Pogba goal in that France-Switzerland game, but I settled on Insigne against Belgium just from the Italy-Belgium game, of course, where he picked it up on the halfway line and just weaved through, like ran through Belgium, got to the, like, you kind of knew once he cut inside what was going to happen, but you still thought, right, Belgium might get a block on this. Not a hope, just that weaving through, arrowing a pure pace, pure dip into the top corner past one of the best goalkeepers in the world. Unbelievable for me. They're the kind of goals that I really, really enjoy, where it's just, you can feel it bubble as you go through, and then you know what's going to happen, and then it does.
It was beautiful. And there's loads of those goals. There's so many, I can remember more goals, obviously I would, but like I can remember more goals from outside of the box than inside. Yeah. Schick is the obvious one that I think, and that's going to go down as the iconic goal from the Euros, for better or for worse. People are going to be talking about Schick versus Scotland. And kind of deservedly so. It's very clever. But again, it's just not for me, because it's like, if you see the keeper off the line, it's like, right, yeah. You had a clever few seconds. And like, it's not that it's not skillful or not great, but there are more skills required for the others. So then you're just picking between a host of things outside the box. Outside the box screamers, and you're looking at like Insigne has that little turn. Do you know what I mean? He just turned Tielemans inside out and then like just turned towards the goal. And again, like there was that inevitability about it. And then it just played out exactly as you thought it would, but it was beautiful in reality. You also had Modric against Scotland, yes. Poor Scotland were very unlucky, but Modric's was slightly better. And I look back through all the kind of best goals of the tournament, but Modric's was like, for me, of the outside the box screamers, probably the best, just because it was first touch outside of the boot and just like clipped it, and it's like, oh my god, the curl on it, everything. Yeah. It's as far as aesthetics, I'd say Modric just was. I would argue that Christensen wasn't even the best goal in that match, though. Do you know what I mean? And I'm gonna go for Damsgaard. And the opening goal in that match. Now Damsgaard, like with the England game as well, he could have a claim for two potential goals of the tournament. But for me, when you're trying to separate these things, it's like, right, what's the best goal? And also then what's the meaning behind it? Do you know what I mean? Because Modric against Scotland and Schick against Scotland both turned out fairly meaningless in the end. The Czechs, you can make a bit of a case for, because it's where they kind of stated, oh, we're going to upset people's kind of perceptions of what we think we are. But like they'd have to get to the final or something to be able to kind of put that bow and rubber stamp on it. The Danes are the story of the tournament overall. And that was the moment where we started to believe. And again, like Christensen was a great goal, but Damsgaard for me was just a bit better. And everything that went behind it and went into it as well, the meaning and the belief that it got us. And also like, it kicked off that night of craziness, because I know we speak about the second round where the 2-3-3 draws, but let's not forget the end of Group B. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's not forget that night. That was absolutely sensational. Damsgaard for me. Let's go for the breakout of the tournament. The player who's raised their stock the most just off this tournament alone. Who have you got?
Speaking of devil, Mikael Damsgaard. Someone who, like, no one would really have kind of come into this tournament going, do you know what, he'll be, and like, you can talk about your Pedris, you can talk about your Donnarummas. They're like, Pedris, Barcelona, Donnarumma, like, he's already got his stock raising. Like, he made his debut when he was 16 and saved the penalty in his debut. And is he close to 100 caps already, I think? And he's only 22. So everyone kind of knew about him. Whereas Mikael Damsgaard got the move to Sampdoria. He's got a 3-year contract now. And you're looking at it and like, surely someone will try and break that, because like, you would have maybe expected him to maybe play a supporting role in that Danish side had everything happened the way it was meant to happen. If Eriksen hadn't collapsed and so on and so forth, Eriksen would have been driving force, and Damsgaard maybe could have been a bit part player in that production. Whereas when Eriksen did go down, and suddenly the entire Danish team are thrust into the limelight, and he's like this 21-year-old who had played 2 games for his country before this tournament, drives his team, is the attacking focal point for this team to get to the semi-finals, steps up with a head like wiser than his age by a considerable distance. 21, like most 21-year-olds at their first tournament would be maybe a bit nervy, whereas he just like, put the country onto his back, with the help, as all the Danes did. But like, you talk about someone raising their stock from pre-tournament, someone will come and pay Sampdoria a lot of money to break that contract, I would imagine, in the summer transfer window.
What I like about the breakout kind of award is that you can take it to mean whatever you want. Do you know what I mean? It can be a player that we'd never heard of, or a player that was kind of on the fringes, or it can be a player that has been doing amazing things, but has now become like one of the global elite. And that's someone I'm going to go for, because the person I'm going to go for has been someone that I've been familiar with and shouting about for years at this stage. They've been a hero of mine. They have commanded a big money transfer to a leading club in Europe. And they've also scored crucial goals within the Champions League. And yet they still remain kind of disrespected and overlooked to a point that they were even not starting the tournament up until like the last game, despite being a key player in their team. Spinazzola could have a claim for this, but obviously the injury kind of put pay to that. And then when they needed him most, he was able to step up. It's Federico Chiesa. He became an absolute linchpin for Italy throughout this tournament, and I am delighted for him. Don't get me wrong, I'm a Fiorentina fan, and he was our hero for years. And to see him move to Juventus, one of our, like, probably our biggest enemy, it hurt quite a lot. But also, I can't help but be thankful for what he gave us for the years and how relevant he made us, because we were nearly in the relegation battle without him this season. But it's so good to see him finally get respect put on his name, to the point that he's an absolute dead cert to start this Sunday against England. And it's the first game because of like the difference he made. Because look, when Italy were down, like Spain were outplaying them the other day, and when Italy were down, he literally took the game by the neck and said, "You're coming with me." Do you know what I mean? Damsgaard, you can make that claim as well. Like, he did the same for Denmark, like by opening the scoring, and kind of they're two solid picks. But Chiesa for me is like, he's the best player on the one team who like kept their high standard from start to finish. And again, coming off the bench, being disrespected, but having the bottle in the right moment, time and time and time again, when his country needs him, there he is. So it's Federico Chiesa for me. That's the breakout, though, the person that raised their stock the most. Now I want to talk about the outright player of the tournament. This is an interesting one.
It is, and there are multiple candidates, but for me, I could not look past Raheem Sterling. Just based off, from start to from the first group game all the way through, he has been the key player for England. It was expected to be Harry Kane, but then there were questions about him after the first whiz. He didn't look too informed at all. He looked maybe even a bit tired from the season. So the next player and the next one that came down was Sterling. And he hadn't really had a massive season for Man City. He had a mixed kind of bag. And look, we talk about the off-the-field stuff as well. Like the homegrown boy grew up in the shadow of Wembley Stadium, opens the scoring for his country in Wembley, in their air quote home ground in the tournament. And then all the way through, as Kane kind of slipped up, Sterling was there at the focal point of pretty much everything that England did good in this tournament. Jack Grealish could possibly help like claim part of that as well. But again, that's down to Southgate bringing him off the bench, where Sterling starting every game, has provided an option for every game. As you mentioned, can turn defenders inside out. With his pace and with his footwork, and I think he's the reason that England are in the fight. Don't get me wrong, their defence excellent as well, but I think everyone kind of expected Southgate to have that kind of defensive rock solidness after all the talk about beforehand. It was what most of people were like, oh, we won't have to worry for goals, we've got Harry Kane. And then suddenly Harry Kane doesn't quite kick off well. Now he's bubbling up a little bit now as we come to the final, which is a worry. But Sterling for me, just from start to finish, has put himself favourite for that award for me.
We agree again. And I think the semi-finals put any doubt aside of this, as he just took England. Like, again, if you're talking about Chiesa taking Italy by the scruff of the neck, you know, Chiesa went off later in that game, you know what I mean? And I think he's going to be fine for Sunday, but there was a bit of a concern throughout the week that he may not be able to play. Raheem Sterling just took England from the start, like, and especially, particularly after Denmark opened the scoring, like, consider that goal was just Raheem Sterling refusing to let England be behind. Like, that's all the goal was. Like, yeah, it was just sheer willpower. And that's what he's been. And when you consider as well where he's come from and what he's had to deal with and the growth he's had to show just within this tournament alone, he was subbed off in the Champions League final that many people believed he shouldn't have started. That was his last match before these Euros, and has single-handedly carried England to the final as their best player and linchpin. proven Southgate right. It's such an amazing story. And I know, again, people like have anti-England sentiment. I don't dispute a lot of it, especially the way their fans have carried on. But the way Sterling has carried himself is just an absolute triumph. When you consider that, like, meanwhile, in his club life, his club are being encouraged to sell him. And they're reportedly, like, offering him to Spurs in exchange for Kane. Would anyone who's been watching the tournament, do you think they're still making that offer? Do you think they're like, we have the best player out of those two? Like Kane is the best player out of those two, Sterling all the way, and personally I'm delighted for him as well. Very likable guy. So finally, let's round it off with the single moment of the tournament, the thing that's going to stick in your head when you think of this tournament. And obviously, you know, we spoke before, again, I think Eriksen is going to be like that whole thing is going to be like, for bad reasons, you know what I mean? And for trauma reasons, that's going to be something that sticks in their head. So I do want to acknowledge that. But let's look at it from a more positive standpoint, like from a great footballing moment.
A great footballing moment. Possibly this isn't one, but it's one that's just going to stick with me in my head because I've been in this position in a similar moment. And it was the face of that poor pitch side reporter in the Hungary-France game after Hungary scored their first goal and immediately rushed over to the crowd. And this poor reporter, with all of her notes, got caught in the middle as 11 angry Hungarians banged the table and notes flew everywhere. And she just looked at the camera like,
I'm gonna die.
Listen, it might just be me as well. I remember, like, you can talk about 20 other different moments, but I have been that journalist in a League of Ireland ground when someone is coming close and you're like, don't come too close, and then your notes and you're going everywhere. It's just, and listen, it was a good, like, it was a massive celebratory moment as well. So look, she was probably delighted to be part of it, but just that horror, I can imagine as that Hungary player slowly approached her like, because there's nothing you can do to stop it. There's nothing you can do if a player's running towards you and you're just there with your notes like, oh. It was just her face, and I'm like, I've just been there.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love it. And that is a sneaky, iconic moment as well. I spoke before about, obviously, Switzerland breaking my reality with the 3-3 equaliser. Morata's penalty miss, I think, as well, deserves to be up there from a just footballer's cruel standpoint. It reminded me a lot of Gareth Southgate's miss in Euro 96, where it's like, oh, not him. No, he's a nice guy. Why did he have to be the one to miss? That's going to affect him. And then you've got like the Damsgaard goal we spoke of and the Christensen goal as well, like Denmark sealing it. Denmark checking live score after the match. Amazing stuff. But for me, and this is a bit odd, it's something that happened before a match, rather before a ball had been even kicked. And it was in the most recent match. It was Wednesday night. It was Wembley. Like, when you consider what this tournament is shepherding us back into normality, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? And it's kind of, you know, it's an old school football tournament. It's a tournament with fans. It's reminding us why we love football. We spoke about how, like, Italy-Belgium, like, if that didn't have fans in it, it'd be a kickabout, a very tense kickabout where they're just kind of passing the ball sideways and they'd probably finish nil all. But because there's fans there egging them on, they're both like urgent and on the run. And that's kind of been what this tournament is. So seeing it capped off like in a Wembley tournament with it filling up, the fans having a sing song, Sweet Caroline, Atomic Kitten, Three Lions, whether you like it or not, it's like hard to not just get into, oh my God, because even like if you're, I watched it on ITV, and like watching, like you had the lads like just getting excited around it. Obviously, everyone's probably seen the clip now afterwards of Ian Wright and Gary Neville just going off script and singing Sweet Caroline, like when they're trying to do analysis. But before the match started, it was like, because it wasn't necessarily, and this isn't like a pro England stance, even like, not that I'm anti England by any means, but like, it was also because Denmark are coming. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, holy shit, like, this is a big game. Like, I had goosebumps as the whistle kicked off. Do you know what I mean? As the whistle started the game, I'm like, holy shit, this is big time. This is real. Like, and just the hype that I had for it. Seeing Schmeichel and Denmark like standing tall during the national anthem for the boos and just being like, oh my God. And like what we spoke of beforehand, how they're going to be in enemy territory, but they're the baby faces. Do you know what I mean? And you're just behind them. It's amazing, amazing tension, amazing stuff. And that for me just Like, again, just hearing like 60,000 people sing the Southgate, "You're the One, Football's Coming Home Again." It was just surreal, hilarious, but also weirdly heartening. And like, yeah, like not only football's coming home, normal life is slowly but surely coming back. You worry, obviously, about the super spreader potential and stuff like that that people are kind of warning about. But for those like couple of hours, we're just like, let's just switch off and enjoy this. There's nothing we can do to change it, so let's just enjoy it.
Yeah, it was essentially like, as you said, just that buzz. And like the last time I had that buzz was in a terrace in Turles for a hurling game 3 years ago, where I was watching, where it's just anticipation of, oh, everything's gonna happen now, right now, and you're like, we're maybe hopefully a couple of months away from that, and the likes of Croker and the Aviva, or even down the road in a League of Ireland game or whatever, just that. Energy of before a game with fans and just magic.
Amazing stuff. Anyway, guys, before we get to the preview and the final, one more time we want to sign off for the teams that couldn't make it this far and kind of pay their tribute, because guys, it's time to say goodbye to the latest two departing teams. Start by saying goodbye to Spain and finally giving them the respect that they deserve. A side who had to do a coaching change and had drama in actually the old coach getting his job back as he was promised during qualifying, as Luis Enrique stepped aside temporarily due to a family tragedy, then had to publicly feud with his successor to get his job back. A side that dealt with question marks from the entire campaign or the outset, from the squad announcement when Enrique left Real Madrid players out, including captain Sergio Ramos, out of the squad entirely. There were a side that dealt with a COVID outbreak as the tournament started, with new captain Sergio Busquets being announced as COVID positive. There were a side that dealt with being mocked and having to confront self-doubt after howlers in the tournament for Unai Simón and Alvaro Morata, but they just dealt with it and got on with it. They've come back from the doubts, they've come back from the adversity, and they've advanced despite the fact that they really had no right to. They're still young, still developing. You'd say maybe the next Euros or World Cup they may be ready to compete, but what a scare they gave the tournament alpha dogs Italy, being the aggressors as the 90 minutes and extra time periods elapsed. We wrote them off every step of the way. They didn't write themselves off until one poor shootout that ended tragically with Morata, of all people. Oh, sport can be so cruel. Having shunned the doubters in this match alone by scoring the equalising goal, being the person to miss. They'll be back, and maybe, just maybe, we'll respect them when they are.
Which leaves me to say goodbye to Denmark, and usually I try and put a joke or a comical comment in here, but not even the most cynical could say anything negative about the Danes, who, as my good co-host pointed out on social media, could easily have just gone, nope, and left the tournament on compassionate grounds, and no one would have judged them at all. But they didn't. They persevered, they gave us multiple moments of the tournament in reality, and on another day when there's not 70,000 fans shouting for a penalty, possibly even got to the final. Farvel, lads. You will always be admired for what you did.
Oh, it's over. It's over. That's the last time we'll do time to say goodbye. I'm going to miss this tournament. Oh, my God. Anyway, look, let's get on to the final. So what we're going to do, rather than just give you an outright pick, is we're going to break it down bit by bit. We're going to pick a team each, and we're going to make the case for them. But then we're going to give a prediction, because this isn't necessarily our prediction, the team we're going with, okay? Kendo, you have been, like, the one outstanding bet that you have left from the entire tournament is Italy to win, which you predicted outright at the start of the tournament. So you're going to cover them and see it through until the end. I'm going to cover England as the team left outstanding. So we'll start off with what we've learned about them so far, looking back into it, what we've learned about them through past matches, through squads, through development and stories as the tournament has progressed.
Yeah, so in the Italian case, before the tournament, they were labelled as dark horses, and then suddenly they came up against actual dark horses in their opening game in Turkey, and everyone was like, "Ooh, listen, this Italian winning streak, they haven't really beaten too many teams that are quality, and Turkey have a bit of quality." and then Italy just came out and dominated them, as they did in all of their group games. They learned their lesson from 2016 against Ireland and didn't roll over in the final match with Wales to finish on top with 9 points and looked relatively comfortable in all of that with the same tactics that Mancini has employed in that 30-game run, which made it all a bit stranger when they struggled against the Austrian side in the knockout rounds. And like, this was the kind of, like, Austria were the kind of level that this 30-game unbeaten run, they were the kind of the top end of that in terms of teams that Italy had beaten. So it was like there was little hints and arrogance of the Italy of old when they started persevering. They're like, look, you're putting it up to us, but it's fine. We're still better than you. And eventually it proves that way. And we'd see that kind of arrogance come in more later in the tournament, particularly in the Belgium game where they went off as underdogs. It didn't really bother them. Mancini stuck with a system that's worked for 3 years, which was grabbing the game by the balls, going two up, and then holding off any potential fight back with them. Again, the seeping in of these classic Italians where it's been labelled as nice as shithousery. Some might call it cheating. Listen, it depends on your outlook on it. But it's worked for them for years. It's worked for them again here. The Spain win maybe has spooked me a little bit because they were very fortunate. As you mentioned, the Spanish dominated that game, particularly in the midfield. And there will be some alarm bells, I would imagine, as to why their usual tactics, when they went 1-0 up, didn't go to plan. Think of how easy Alvaro Morata that goal was. It was a simple 1-2, and Morata ran straight through the middle of the defence. But look, again, they persevered, they held out, and they got there on penalties. Some might say that's fortunate. Some might say it's just penalties. It's what it is. But I don't think we've learned in too much about them that we didn't know already before this tournament.
As far as England goes, we've learned that Southgate's England are a brutally efficient side, built in the exact same mold as every side who's had international success over the past decade. Literally, Southgate has said it. He modelled them on Portugal in 2016 and France in 2018. Difficult to score against? Check. They've conceded just one this entire tournament. They're the first team to go the first five games without conceding a goal. Able to dominate possession, dictate the terms and wear opponents down into submission. We can pretend, because we like the Danes and the story that they had, that they didn't have them hanging on for dear life at the end of 90 minutes and all throughout extra time. But we'd be lying to ourselves if we said any otherwise. They dictate every game they're in. Are they capable of scoring goals from multiple different facets? Look at this. Sterling is a star reborn. Harry Kane has stumbled into 4 goals despite being a poor overall and missing penalties during that. Jack Grealish is maybe their biggest attacking threat in terms of unlocking defences, and he doesn't even start. Jadon Sancho and Marcus Rashford are available off the bench at a moment's notice. Harry Maguire has become a consistent attacking threat for them from every single set piece. You are never ever safe against this England side. They have just too many options. They are built to win international tournaments. They have modeled themselves on it, and they are succeeding in doing so. So that's what we've learned so far. Let's go into the coaching battle, though, and let's make our cases for Roberto Mancini versus Gareth Southgate.
Look, you have to praise Mancini for the reaction to that Spain game where he saw his team being dominated, which was no reaction. He kept as calm as possibly could be. His usual tactics of getting the ball up to Mobley in space were not working, but he persevered again. And he was rewarded by that lack of panic, where other managers might have tried to tinker around with the formation or maybe bring someone off the bench. Mancini settled, and they did go 1-0 up. Immediately after which, he whiffed off a Mobley to copy the Spain tactic of a false nine with Insigne to try and capitalize for a second goal on the counter. Before that Spain game, Italy had conceded just 6 shots per game on average and averaged a remarkable 17 shots per game going the other way. They are rock solid defensively, led by their talisman, who we'll get to in a bit. And the transition from defence into attack is almost club-like. It seems like this is a club team just on an international stage. That translates to off the pitch too. Our star is the group is a common comment from players when asked about standouts in this tournament. That has been drilled into them by Mancini. And the boss himself it's a major part of that, because before the tournament, we saw him playing ping pong with frying pans on an Italian game show, and leaving the other night after they beat Spain, he was right in the middle of that group that were looking down the camera and chanting Spina, Spina towards Spinazzola after the Spain victory with the jerseys on and everything. So he's got this, as I said, rock solid group. He's got them defensively drilled well. He's got the tactics spot on as well, we mentioned it before, the 4-3-3 that turned into a 3-2-5 with the wingbacks coming forward. It's working, and it's working again. And that's just, that is a manager who is resolute. It does not matter what the opposition is. He is going to play his way.
If there's a single person on this planet who doubts Gareth Southgate's coaching and man management ability, take one look at the person we've named both as the player of the tournament, Raheem Sterling, particularly on Wednesday night. That is a triumph of coaching right there. But then compare what Southgate has done compared to supposed legendary England coaches past, like Fabio Capello or Sven-Goran Eriksson, people who come with legitimate coaching CVs, whereas you look at Southgate's and you're like, well, Middlesbrough didn't do too well. And look at like what they had. They had a similar embarrassments of talents at their disposal. On paper, this isn't necessary. It is a really, really strong England squad. Don't get me wrong. But you could make cases that there have been stronger over the past 30 years. But think about how many coaches' reputations went down the drain trying to answer the dilemmas like how to fit Gerrard and Lampard in the same lineup. As we detailed in our initial Euros preview, Southgate has four or five of these dilemmas across the pitch. And he's been ruthlessly efficient in doing so. 6 months ago, who would have guessed when you looked at the England squad and who's available to them, that Calvin Phillips would play all but 25 minutes on the entire road to the final, or that Saka would become a key player within the knockout phase, while Jadon Sancho and Marcus Rashford would spend most of the tournament on the bench and everyone would be okay with this. That's mental. That's what makes coaches great. When you come into the England camp, you leave your reputation and what you've done at your club at the door, and what counts is what you've done for England. That goes as much for if things have gone poorly at club level too, hence Sterling and Kane accounting for 70% of goals for between them, while nobody knows who they'll actually play for next season. Southgate has shown ruthlessness, like substituting Jack Grealish, who was a sub himself after the lead against Denmark had been secured, in order to shore up the defence. That is fruitless efficiency there that doesn't give a fuck what you think. Consider the reaction to Grealish, the standing ovation he got, and then as soon as he got what he needed out of him, he's like, nope, you're coming off again. And consider also the dressing room that he's dealing with, okay? Your Marcus Rashford, your Raheem Sterling, your Jadon Sancho's. The dressing room are opinionated. They're not afraid to speak up, whether it's against their own fans or their own government. And they're full of big egos that are big stars at their own club. And yet, with Gareth Southgate shepherding them, they buy in, respect, and give everything for Southgate, even when it affects them negatively. Like, look at Jack Grealish. Look at, like, how he's performed for Southgate, even when everyone's like, he should start, he should start. And how often do we see players just buy into their own hype? But Jack Grealish gets on with it and does whatever he can when he comes off the bench, and then just goes back onto the bench if Southgate deals with him just fine. That says all you need to know right there. What Southgate has done with this England side, especially when you consider the 30 years of hurt, is among one of the great. And like, here's the thing, I have a lot of respect for Mancini. And if, like, when you consider that Mancini was the guy to bring the Premier League Championship back to City, and also if he can see out these Euros, do you know what I mean? That's one of the great coaching triumphs. But what Gareth Southgate has already done with England is the stuff of legends. It's up there with Ferguson. It's up there with Shankly. It's up there with, like, any coaching achievements that you can think of when you look at everything that could have gone wrong and everything that's working against them. Amazing, amazing stuff from Southgate. Yeah. So next up, what we're going to look at is the players on the pitch who are doing the thing. So let's pick three key players and let's look into why they'll help them win this match.
For me, the biggest decision that will turn this final, will decide this final, will be in the midfield. And it's actually not who the Italians choose, it's who Southgate puts up against them, because Jorginho has had, look, he showed balls of steel from the spot against Spain, as he has done. He's got a Matt Letizia-esque record on the field. Thankfully, not off the field, but that's beside the point. But for the 120 minutes before that, the midfield really couldn't get things going due to the Spanish press and the lack of that release valve of Spinazzola, where Emerson was untested. If Southgate sticks with the side that beats Denmark, you have to imagine it'll be Mason Mount, possibly tasked with the job of sticking to Jorginho, leaving someone else to deal with Verratti. If Jorginho and Verratti, and I'm focusing on Jorginho, but Verratti is equally as important, if they are left to dictate the style and to take the pace of the game, I don't know how England can stop them. So, like, those two are key, and Southgate has to get that decision right, because we've seen Jorginho deep lying as he does with Chelsea, deep lying and able to spray a ball anywhere. Calm under pressure when he's got his back facing, or his back facing to the goal, facing towards his own goal, I should say. So I think the choice of who gets put on him is key. Secondly, as you mentioned already, Federico Chiesa. He's one of the side stories of the tournament by following in his father's footsteps. And crucially, the 23-year-old can match what England bring in the pace stakes going forward. So, if Luke Shaw and Kyle Walker continue with their tactic of ploughing forward against Mancini's 4-3-3, they will be absolutely ripe for the picking on the counter with those five players flooding forward that Italy's formation turns into on the break. And Chiesa is key to that. And then in direct contrast to him is the wise old head of the Roman table. Giorgio Chiellini has shown, why many coaches consider him to be the best centre-back in football, both during the games and when at the coin toss before the shootout the other night. Everyone's like, oh, great tactical mind games. And like, no, it's just what he is. He's just mental. Usually he and Bonucci are left with one other person to protect Donnarumma, who is also massive in this game, by the way. I just decided not to fit it. I couldn't fit him in ahead of the other three. But like, he's made 20 claims. I think what's the second highest amount of claims from crosses in this box in the tournament. And that'll be key on Sunday. But Chiellini will need to be ready to give another masterclass here, as England's three-headed monster of Kane, Sterling and Saka or Sancho can stretch the Italian rearguard. If he gets caught coming deep with Kane, that leaves space in behind where Bonucci will be left unprotected. So, like, if all three of them are on form, I can't really see how England can win that game. But again, that is a big if.
And yeah, like, and that comes down to, and that's why we watch, and that's what the final is, which of the key players will show up. So Sterling, we've spoken about, no surprise he's mentioned here after the past hour of gushing over him. He's England's linchpin now, and he'll run all day for Southgate. Watching him is both a pleasure and frustrating at times. As earlier, I compared him to Anthony Martial, running right at defenders rather than making a simple pass. If you're a fan of that, and having watched Martial, I feel it, where you're just like, just pass it to Fernandez, just pass it instead of fucking sprinting. But with Sterling, though, it tends to work. He's so quick and skillful that he regularly breaks the brains of world-class defenders. England's equaliser against Denmark, like we said earlier, was basically Sterling just running the ball at Denmark so insistently that they ended up putting it in their own net because they didn't know how else to handle it. Chiellini would be looking to break him up early, but in the same weekend, we have a great fighting card. It'll be the old adage of, if the powerful fighter can even lay a glove on his speedy foe. If he can lay a glove on him, Sterling might calm down and he might be negated. If he's negated, that's a big deal. But there's a big question of if he's able to, because Denmark, we're not. Speaking of, anyway, the big powerful fighter trying to make a statement, Harry Maguire has become absolutely essential in maintaining England's sturdiness at the back, while also, as stated, becoming a genuine attacking threat off every set piece now. There are still somehow people who snigger at the price Man United paid Leicester for him, or the fact that Southgate risked bringing him when he wasn't fully fit at the start of the tournament. Do you know what I call those people? They're people who aren't watching Harry Maguire matches. His composure and presence means Italy likely won't get the fast break goals that they have from Chiesa and Insigne in recent rounds. But speaking of Chiesa, because he's someone that definitely needs to be watched out for, Luke Shaw similarly will be the person tasked with dealing with him, and he's become England's golden boy against all odds of his career. As well as being a permanent attacking threat, he will be crucial here, as Spinazzola's injury has meant a lot of Italy's interlinking has to come down the right now instead of the left, because they're not going to rely as much on Emerson, even though he is doing a lot of attacking and leaving them vulnerable behind. This means we're likely going to see a lot of Chiesa versus Shaw, and the winner of that battle could be absolutely pivotal. So that's where what will happen is, how the teams are going to win the game. But what we want to do now is break down the specific scenario that it would take for the team to win the game. If the game is this way, and then we'll kind of get to our own predictions and how we feel the game actually will pan out. Here's the scenario where Italy will win if the game goes this
way. Italy will win this game if they do four things right. If they withstand the early onslaught, because in the majority of England's games so far, they've played relatively the same way from the whistle. They have an early slew of chances in the first 15 minutes before the game settles down a bit. And then there's an inverse for the second half. The first 15 minutes are slow before a switch is flicked on the hour mark and pressure ramps up and they create most of their chances. Secondly, they need to shut down Sterling. Kane hasn't been excellent so far in the tournament, but as Rick correctly pointed out on our last show and on this show, teams still have to deal with him. when he drops deep, there is acres of space in behind, and Sterling will fancy his chances again, particularly against a tiring defense with the centre-backs, the likely centre-backs, having a combined age of 70. Giovanni Di Lorenzo and Emerson, or even Rafael Toloi, will need to stay on top of the Man City winger and potentially a fresh Grealish off the bench too. Italy also needs to get things right at set pieces. Shaw's been one of England's standouts, and his dead ball deliveries are a huge part of that. If you look back, look, obviously England getting a free around the middle of the goal is fine. They've got multiple chances there. But when they get a free kick out towards the left-hand sideline, Shaw does the exact same thing. He fizzes it towards the penalty spot every single time. When it's on the opposite flank, Kyle Walker will float it with the perfect amount of height and speed towards the back post. They're both looking for the same target, and it is Harry Maguire, whose timing is near perfection in this tournament. Denmark have to put two players up against him each time. So if Maguire's marker is slacking, SpongeBob Squarehead could have a field day against Italy. And lastly, they need to be cuter than England. This is the battle of shithousery against 70,000 fans. Because, look, the pressures will get to the... Like, it's a European final and pressures do come on referees. That's absolutely fine. And it'll all be a case of, can Italy out-shithouse England? Can Italy out-shithouse Harry Kane, who is... Played much a blinder in that art of winning freeze where he kicks the ball ahead and then just gets the shoulder in or gets his back in, and then a player comes through his back and down he goes. It's still a foul. They have to be all around the refs. They have to be kind of tune out the crowd and just play the game. But also, like, we've seen them against Belgium, we've seen them against Spain, where, I mean, that clip of Immobile has gone viral since of, like, oh, listen, he's down in the penalty area. Oh, look, he scored, they're up. And we're going to see plenty more of that. It's just that they can do it more and they can get in the ref's ear more than England. If they're able to do all of those things, I have them winning in normal time.
Okay, interesting. In England, they're going to win, and we're quite similar. Like, I think that we know the setup for this match, and we know how both teams are going to play. First off, if Shaw can keep Chiesa from doing Chiesa things, like, that's the main thing. If Shaw can shut down Chiesa, that's Italy, like, done, because their flip side is they had Spinazzola, him linking in with Insigne, created, like, a lot of opportunities, and, like, that's how the team linked up with Jorginho and Verratti, kind of unlocking teams from behind, and then turning it into, like, the five up front that we spoke of already. So the truth is that, like, what's going to happen is Italy will have to turn around, and they're gonna approach this in a classic Italian manner. England are going to look to go with this from the front foot, and Italy will be happy to absorb them, let them tire themselves out, hit them on the counter, or pick them off late if needed. Like, they would love a goal like they got against Spain. And that was kind of a textbook kind of what this Italy side has to be to succeed now. An early goal for England would be a huge boost, as it was then allowed them to start dominating possession and lead from the front foot when, as we saw against Ukraine and when they shut the game down against Denmark in the second half of extra time, they can then start to pick their opponents apart as their opponents get more desperate in their need to attack. We saw against... this is an interesting part that I think is going to be crucial. England had huge success with Saka and Sterling linking up on the right-hand side against Denmark, who were weak on the left because they had Mela going forward a lot, especially as they needed to attack more. That's going to be key because, of course, on the left-hand side of England or Italy's defence, you have Emerson, who plays more of a wing-back role. So there's going to be space in behind him, but also he's not as in tune with this team as possible. So there is your angle where Sterling can do a lot of damage. It just depends how Italy prepare for that, if they identify it and if they counteract it. So that's going to be worth watching as well. I don't see Italy being able to run rampant and dominate the game here without Spinazzola. I don't see them particularly trying to either. Their number one tactic would be don't concede and trust themselves to score if the opportunity arises, the old Italian mantra. England, though, are too good with too many options and the stakes are too high to take any unnecessary risks otherwise. So for England, it's all about being patient, being disciplined and just chipping away at Italy without allowing them an opening to pick you off. Basically, England just have to run back the playbook from how they played Denmark, and we've seen them do it and win convincingly too. Now, the question becomes, will they? Who do we think? We've made the case and we've assigned ourselves to those two teams. They are necessarily our final picks. So now we're going to ask you to get off the fence, Kento. Nail your colours to the mast. You picked Italy at the start of the tournament to win outright. Here they are in the final. And, like, as well, as we'll discuss with our bets, if they win, you win the tournament yourself. You are in the green for the entire tournament based off that one bet still being alive. Are you still picking Italy to win?
I am. Because I feel that all the work that will have gone in the last few days on the training ground for Mancini, I feel anyway, will be on that midfield and why that midfield did not really work as well as it did against the Spanish press. And as I said, it all depends on what Southgate does as well, because does he start Jordan Henderson? Who, I'll remind you, before this tournament, Roy Keane was like, what are you bringing him here for? Does he do magic tricks? And if he does, who does that leave Calvin Phillips to mark? And who does, like, which one of Rice and Phillips drops out? And does Mason Mount, where does he fit? Whereas you know Italy are going to have Jorginho, Verratti and Barella. So, like, you know they're going to have to beat those three have played together the last two or three years in that team. They know each other inside out. They know what jobs they have to do. And I agree with you in the sense that I feel Italy will be looking to frustrate them, probably even for an hour in the game, and just try and get a goal. But I don't know if Italy go ahead and look, we saw Denmark go ahead, and that was a big question going into that Denmark game. Remember that England hadn't been behind, how would they react? And I have to say, Sterling just went low behind, we'll see how long that lasts. I don't know if he'll be able to do it as much against, well, as freely, I should say, against Denmark, against Italy as he did against Denmark. And it also depends, like, listen, if they go behind within 15 minutes, there's loads of time. If they go behind maybe just before halftime, I can see that happening. I can see Italy squeezing them, like being lovely and defensive and being typically Italian for the majority of the first half, and then getting one on the counter maybe as a halfway line, just when it looks like it's going to go in nil all. That'll leave them chasing second half. So I'm going for 2-0 to Italy. I'm going for England to not panic, but plough forward, but just not be able to find as much as the hole, as much as the freedom, as much space as they did against a tiring Denmark side, who had been through a hell of a lot in that tournament. Like, the freshness argument maybe doesn't go on with, like, a penalty shootout against extra time. They both went to extra time. That's something that I've been looking at throughout the tournament as well, that teams might have had an extra day's rest. I don't think that applies here because it's a European final. But I have Italy 2-0. Based off and going ahead early, maybe in the first half, and then frustrating them in the second half and picking them off on the counter.
England, the country, don't deserve to win this. And Italy, the country, absolutely do. The Euros, as we said, have been almost a celebration of a return to normal. And to see a country that was ravaged so brutally by COVID, their football team only making a comeback from a humiliating few years, it'd be so fitting and beautiful to see Mancini's young side do the job. But then you zoom into England and you zoom into their squad and coaching staff and you start to see a collection of people who all of a sudden they actually do deserve it, who can become immortal with 90 successful minutes against a side missing arguably their best player in Wembley, the exact same place they won their last piece of major silverware. There's a poetry to England here. There's a symmetry to it all that makes it all seem inevitable that they'll both win and lose. They're going to win because they've overcome so many of their past demons. They've won on penalties in 2018. They've held their nerve when so many England teams before them would have bottled it here. And they're going to lose because that's what happens every time an England side look nailed on for success. So it's tough to kind of judge on paper and based off narrative. And that's the thing with football finals. They don't necessarily go to decide who deserves to win on paper. Chelsea won the last major football finals that we've seen. The third best side in England being crowned the best side in Europe somehow. I think Italy's unbeaten streak continues for one more match. But I didn't say they were lifting the trophy. We've been close so far, and we've been getting closer to it, but we haven't seen England go to penalties yet. So if they are to truly show that they are a new breed of English footballers, they must face their foe once more. How, like in this, which has been arguably the best international tournament of our times, how fitting would it be to close with England having to go to penalties to win it all? Is football coming home? It's literally in Wembley. The desperation among their fans, it's all there. And the story of this entire tournament, when you look at these two teams on paper, is how it's nearly impossible to score against either of these sides if they don't want you to. So I'm picking this final to be a boring nil-all draw with the most dramatic climax possible. England win on penalties. Yes, I said it. Football's coming home. God help us all.
And like it's Three Lions is top of the charts in Ireland at the moment. So you're not the only one secretly tipping England. I'd say
I like that column as well. it's not that I want to see that happening. I'm neutral. I'm not against England winning, but like I'm interested in that, and that's why I think it's going to happen when I come down to it. And I will put my money where my mouth is in a second. But first, we want to get onto our bets. We're going to do what we've been doing all tournament throughout the knockout phases. We're going to give you £20. You can bet it all on the football if you like on this game, or you can spread it out because it's a busy sporting weekend. So, Kendo, how are you spending your last €20 so far? Just to recap, you are behind. You've won €34.50 out of €110 spent so far. Okay, so both of us are behind, by the way. Okay, so like we start the show saying we're not good gamblers, and we're very clear about that. So you're behind me though. I've won €65.48. However, what you've got left is you've got Italy to win €10 at 11-1 from the start of the tournament. Like we said, that'll win you the whole tournament, and there's very little I can do. Even if all my bets come in, it's very unlikely that I'd overthrow you, even though I've won €30 more than you off this so far. The outstanding bets that I have left that I've placed already is the field versus Novak Djokovic in Wimbledon, which is looking... it's not looking great. It's not looking great at all as we play the men's semifinals as we record. And also the NBA finals, the Suns winning in six with Chris Paul getting MVP. The Suns are looking nailed on to win. The only threat there is the in six part where they may just sweep them because they're that much better than the Milwaukee Bucks. But the first two games, they're leading 2-0. The first two games have been in Phoenix. They're going back to Milwaukee for the next two games. So that's still very much in play. So how are you spending your last €20 to try turn this around?
So I'll split it up into €4 or €5 bets. The first one is Italy to win the final in 90 minutes. I've got 2-1 odds on that on Bet365 and putting a fiver on that. My second two, I'm going back to the GAA and I'm going back up to Ulster. I think Cavan against Tyrone. Cavan are being looked over a bit too much for my liking. Everyone's focusing on, look, they were relegated to Division 4 in the league. But you seem to forget that they won Ulster last year from Division 3. I don't believe the gap between them and Tyrone is as big as people say it is. So I've got Cavan to cover the handicap at +5 at 21-20. I've got a fiver on that. And I have got Donegal again. They worked for me last time against Down. And I've got a fiver on them to beat Derry by 6 or more at evens. I think that's a lovely price, especially for this quality in depth that Donegal have. And that leaves me with one fiver. And it's more of a long-term bet because it's literally putting it on something that's made today. And I just really wanted to talk about the World Match Play Darts. There's no odds available as of yet. The draw was made while we were recording, but I'm backing Mensur Suljovic to win the World Match Play. Now, his draw could have been nicer. In the first round, he's playing Gerwyn Price, the world number one and world champion. But he likes... I'll put it to you this way. He's in the better half of the draw because on the other side, so... He's in Gerwyn's quarter, but on the other side of the draw, you've got Peter Wright, Michael Smith, Michael Van Gerwen, Gary Anderson, and Nathan Aspinall. He only has to play one of them in the final if he gets there. Sorry, and Jose de Souza as well. So, Suljovic loves match play format, so leg play, we've talked about that before on an old Paddy's New Yacht, how some players just prefer it. He likes the match play. He's been there, I think, 7 times. He's reached the quarterfinals or more on 6 of those occasions, including a final defeat to Gary Anderson a few years ago in overtime. And his only other TV major that he's won is a leg play format, the Champions League of Darts, a year and a half ago. Similarly enough as well, Price... not really a major fan of leg play because he can be very temperamental. And Suljovic loves playing temperamental players because he's slow, he's methodical, he doesn't care who he's against in it. Himself and Gary Anderson nearly had a scrap on stage the last time they played. My one worry with that, he hasn't really been in the majors a lot due to COVID. Travel, obviously, he's based in Austria. He took time away. He's got a young family as well. So I don't know, but he's there on his as an unseeded player off his pro tour ranking. He's actually dropped out in the world's top 16, but he's still there as a dangerous player. Likes match plays, and then all right, if he can get past Price, I don't see many else in the bottom quarter that can stop, or in his half that can stop him. So it'll just be a case of can he get to the final and can he win it all? So that's who I've got. I'll wait for the odds to come out. I'd imagine that'll be decent enough. So this might be a retroactive if Italy don't win. like if Mensah is like 33-1, it might be a retroactive in a month or two. I'll tweet about it. But 5-run Sulevich, 5-run Cavan, 5-run Italy, 5-run Donegal.
Okay, interesting. I like it. I've paired up because the Euros final isn't the only major football final happening this weekend, because we've got an absolute dream Copa America final, Brazil against Argentina. So what I've done is I've paired up 2 5-er doubles on the two matches, okay, on various different things. First off is a shit crack bet that I hate doing, but it's also what I believe will happen. I'll put a €5 double on under 2.5 goals in both games, okay? Because the problem with Brazil and Argentina is it always looks delicious on paper, but it always ends up really kind of low scoring, boring, tense, tight. And it's just one of those things. Both defenses in the Copa have been stout so far. Brazil, they both made it to the final, like, and I bet on both of them. I bet Brazil won the last episode, and I bet in Argentina to beat Colombia. Brazil ended up just winning 1-0, so lost that, and Argentina needed penalties to beat Colombia after drawing 0-0. So that's kind of what you're dealing with there. They are a low scoring team so far, and Brazil is going to be missing Gabriel Jesus, who was injured against Peru. And then you look at kind of their options at back, like even in goals you have like Brazil have the choice between Alisson and Ederson, and then you've got Argentina where Emilio Martinez is doing absolute heroics in the penalty shootout. He was phenomenal against Colombia, so he's having an absolute worldie. So I like that bet under 2.5 goals, a double on that. And I am getting, sorry, I'm getting near evens for that, but like again, it's a solid bet. You can win your money back, and double it there. I've also got a double on England and Argentina to lift the trophy. We've discussed England already, so Argentina, they're 2 years undefeated. Ironically, their last defeat was in 2019, with it being against Brazil in the last Copa America semi-final. But the thing is, they've improved quite a lot in the meantime, and in a battle of Messi versus Neymar, where they're competing to win their first major international honour, where the tale of the tape has it that basically this game will be won by the linchpin's force of will, okay? They are so evenly matched throughout the side. I'm going to go Team Messi here. He's been the outstanding player in both this tournament and in their respective careers. I have him winning here. If it was a World Cup game, or if the lights were a bit stronger, I may be tempted to head towards Neymar, but I think Messi's going to win it. I think he's finally got it down that this is what he wants to do. So I have them both to lift the trophy. They can win in penalties, even if it goes that far. And I have that at just over 3-1, a 5-er. I've done the exact same as Kento, broke it into €4 or €5 bets. UFC 264 is on this weekend. I put a 5-er on that. I would love to stick it on Dustin Poirier to win it all against Conor McGregor. As like, I reposted my old Conor McGregor podcast during the week, if you want to give it a listen after he lost to Poirier. And it's a conversation we're going to need to have, how to deal with the Conor McGregor fan in your life and the shite that they come out with at times. Unfortunately, I can't be fully confident to the point I put money on it. Reason being, I don't know how motivated he is. Poirier is cutting a very chilled, relaxed figure, knowing that he's getting the biggest payday of his life this weekend. He's already beaten McGregor. Even his press conferences, like, and they had their press conferences last night. I don't like judging fights on hunger, because like they're not won based on who's hungrier. They're won based on who has the better attributes. Poirier is probably more skilled than McGregor, but I also think McGregor is working harder than him. I think Poirier, he's a cup final basically waiting to happen here. McGregor is hungry. He knows that he can get back in the title conversation with a win here. Now Khabib has gone out of the picture. So I'd probably lean towards McGregor, but I don't want to bet on him either. So what I've done is I've got Corper Keane, who obviously went through his, like, kind of, when he was a guest on it the other week, he went through his kind of outside tips for UFC 264. I've got him to put a treble on for me with his tips and what he feels confident in. Here's how we pick, though. I'm going to read out what he sent me word for word. So he's Michel Pereira to beat Nico Price in the prelims. He's very confident on the result, but has no idea how it happens. Pereira just mashes every button on his controller, so it could be a KO submission decision potential everywhere. He might optimistically go with a second round knockout because Nico's been knocked out several times before. I'm just betting on Pereira to win outright. Sean O'Malley knocks out his short notice opponent in the first round easily. I believe he's as good as the UFC want them to be, even if most fans don't. So I have Sean O'Malley first round. round. And if Gilbert Burns to beat Wonder Boy by decision, Keane is very confident in this result, which means it probably won't happen. But there you go. He made the case last week. If you want to go listen to it, it is a compelling case. But for a treble with those three, I've got nearly 7-1 odds. So I'll make around €40 back on that if that comes to pass. I really, really like that bet. And lastly, with my last €5, I've still got my the field versus Djokovic bet alive for Wimbledon, as we discussed, although I'm not feeling very confident. I think that's a sunk cost as Sunday grows nearer. So I'm going to put my final €5 on the women's final. World number one Ash Barty is looking to become the first Australian women's champion at Wimbledon since 1980. She's lost just one set en route to the final and has a 5-2 head-to-head record over her opponent, Karolina Pliskova. Pliskova's serve means that she should hold a lot, which keeps her in every set. So I've got €5 on Barty to win in 3 sets, and that gives me 12-5 odds as well. So I get 12 back for that. So we will find out. And I'll post on Twitter, don't worry, who wins the kind of win after we see how Mensah Sulevic gets on. I think that's going to be the longest outstanding bet. But I will keep tabs on who wins that.
The odds have just landed in there. He's 125-1. I'm holy all over shit. That. Holy even shit. Each way, I might go all over that.
And you put a fiver on it. Okay, well, look, Kendo, if that happens, you definitely win. But
yes, also, yes I would hope.
Keep in mind those odds are generally in play for a reason.
yes, they are. And it's got nothing to do with the fact that he gets the world number one in his first game. Yeah. One time Van Gerwen isn't the number one. And he... Anyway,
look, we have one bit of business to take care of as we wrap up this limited series of Paddy's New York. We're going to play the last version of Kent on Kent. Kent, you won last night. It was a draw last night.
I did. Right? I finally got a win.
You won. Okay.
So listen, one win out of about 13 in the last 13 Paddy's New York episodes. I think that's all right.
One out of three. And then if you were to win today, it's 2 out of 4. Okay, and usually what we do in this for newer listeners, what we do in Kendo Kent is we interview Kendo about stories that he's reported. We're going to switch it up slightly this week, okay? Because I'm going to focus in on one particular story you wrote, a controversial story that you wrote during the week relating to this. Where Kendo made the argument that Irish fans. We should be England fans. Is that what you're saying?
We should have, like, out of the teams that were left at that time, England were nice ones to support. I mean, 25% of Irish people said they were supporting England.
Okay, so we're going to focus on Kent on Kent, Tan edition. So since you're a huge England football fan now, what we're going to do is we're going to quiz your knowledge on the Three Lions and their history. So look, I think this gives you a chance. I think you're in with a chance here. This is a fair final quiz.
Yeah,
majorly out of this, but we'll test if you live up to your word, as we always do on Kent on Kent, or we'll find out if it was just for hashtag clicks. We shall see.
Answer will shock you.
Question one. 5 questions, and you have to get 3 to win. Sunday could mark only the second major international tournament win in England's history. But who was the man that scored a hat-trick to give England their sole World Cup win in 1966?
Jeff Hurst, final answer. I'm glad, because I thought you were going to ask me the other score.
No. I gave you one there. I knew you'd probably get one. All right, so that's it. That's your gimme. That's your gimme. Question 2. Of course, England's Euro 2020 song has become a takeoff. Atomic Kitten's Hole Again. It's Football's Coming Home Again. What I want you to do now is name for me 2 members of Atomic Kitten aside from Kerry Katona.
Oh, good luck. Oh, no.
See, the gimme at the start was because it gets really difficult straight away.
Do you know what? I was only looking this up during the week as well because Amanda Holden was singing it on the radio and I was like, she was not in that group. Good. No. My logic here is to look for Celebrity Big Brother participants in the last 5 or 6 series of it, because that's usually where the British pop stars end up.
Don't be looking at it.
Ash that. I want to say there was a Richards in there, but I have zero logic. So let's go Jenna Richards and... And he wasn't a Romanian president last week, so let's go Rick Nash. Final answer.
Okay, so was I a member of Atomic Kitten? The answer will show... No, I wasn't. Could have got any four from Heidi Range, Natasha Hamilton, Liz McLaren, and Jenny Frost. There you go. Okay, yeah. So...
Jenny Frost wasn't Celebrity Big Brother. I should have continued with my logic.
The more you know... Three. Euro 96 has been getting a lot of airplay this past few weeks for obvious reasons. The comparisons are just right there. Of course, famously, England's Euro 96 campaign ended with Gareth Southgate missing a penalty. But what was the current coach's squad number in the tournament? How close attention have you been paying to the old clips?
Yeah, the Three Lions video starts with it.
Three Lions 98 video.
Three Lions 98, as I said in my opinion piece, the better one.
That made me so angry. That entire piece.
That 98 was... Well, like, I could have brought in the fact that Walkers are better than Tato and Corey's better than Fair City, but, you know.
I've never seen someone so wrong in so few words. What was the squad number?
For some reason, 4 is in my head, but 96, I don't know if David Batty is retired at that stage. I don't think he had. I'm going to go 18, final answer.
18. Okay, interesting. You could have logged it out, thinking that, like, obviously he's a centre-back.
Yeah.
He was England's starting centre-back.
Yeah, that was where my issue was.
Which is generally, you know, you're looking at number 5. Or the correct answer, number 6.
6.
Like, if you're looking at centre-backs, it's usually one or the other. If they have a midfielder who's 4, it's going to be the centre-back is 6.
I wasn't sure if he was starting or not, and that's where the issue was.
There we go. Done your homework on your new favourite team. Question 4. I think you might get this. New Manchester United signing Jadon Sancho has made just one start in these Euros. But what was the club that originally signed England's Euros benchwarmer? It's been getting a lot of, like, it's been spoken about a lot over the past few weeks with the story. You have an Athletic subscription.
Originally signed, as in from...
So the first kind of football contract they would have had with any football club. Professional football club.
Oh, no.
Obviously,
it's not Dortmund.
Okay, where did he come from with Dortmund then?
2030.
Trying to think if I give you a clue. Do you know what? It's the end of the series. I appreciate you doing these limited shows with me. I'll give you a clue. They play with the same colour as Dortmund. Same colour jersey. So he signed for Dortmund from Manchester City. But he signed for City from this club with the same colour jersey as Dortmund.
Okay. As in, so... predominantly yellow and black as opposed to predominantly black and yellow.
I've given you enough clues. I've literally told you the colour of the jersey. Like, that has narrowed it down to, like, what, 15 clubs? We do need an answer.
I know.
Ideally.
Right.
with subscriptions to The Athletic are screaming at
Yes, they are. I am one of those people, but there has been so much content on The Athletic. I haven't gone through it all.
It's worth every penny.
It's so good. Like, it's a euro.
Worth every penny.
So and also the Irish Mirror. Read our stuff too, please. Okay.
Read more than one thing.
It's a shot in the dark because I don't know, but I'm just thinking around the area now. So I'll go for sorry, I can hear the music.
Like, the music has stopped three times now.
Yeah. Shrewsbury Town, final answer. They're blue and yellow, but yeah.
Of course, I knew that because it is the wrong answer. It's the wrong answer.
Yeah. One.
It was Watford. He signed from Watford.
I was thinking, yeah, I was thinking around Manchester, I think. No worries.
You can sign for teams that aren't in your area.
I know, but I'm
signing for Dortmund. Like,
at his age, I'm like.
Still, you signed for Dortmund. We'll go for it anyway. See how you round it off. See if he can end on a positive, if not a win. Unsurprisingly, this isn't the first time England and Italy have squared off in the Euros. They've squared off multiple times. But who won the last Euros tie between the two? It's a 50-50 shot here.
Italy on penalties, final answer.
You seem like insanely confident with that one.
I'm 99% sure it was Pirlo with the Panenka.
To end what's been an abysmal Kent on Kent run on a high note. It's the correct answer! Euro 2012, Italy defeated England on penalties. Will the roles be reversed this week, though? Let's find out. It could be absolutely amazing. I've literally put money on it. It's going to be amazing this Sunday. Kendo, it has been an absolute pleasure to do this limited run of podcasts with you again. And this isn't the last you're going to hear of Paddy's New Year. We'll find reasons to come back and chat shit about sports. It's what we really enjoy to do. So don't worry. Kendo, thank you so, so much for joining us. Guys, if you're not already, what are you doing? Follow him on social media. Follow Kendo CCFC on Twitter, David Kendo on Facebook. If you want to get his articles, you can follow his journalist page. Absolute pleasure as always. Can't wait to be back, finding more excuses to chat about sports over the next coming months. But in the meantime, guys, thank you for listening to our inane ramblings and for putting up with us. As I really hope that you didn't lose as much money as we have on this. But who knows? We still have time to turn it all around because we've got a system, guys, and the system never fails. In the meantime, guys, thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us, David Kent. I've been Rick Nash. This has been Paddy's New Yacht.